Hello, and welcome to Thank the Academy, the podcast where we talk about every Academy Award winning Best Picture in order. This is the Academy Archives, and this week we're discussing Academy Award winning films Tender Mercies and Flashdance, and Academy Award winning actress Shirley MacLaine. We're your hosts, Zach and Kristen, and that's our producer, Kayla.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
We're finally back.
Yes, we're so happy to be back with another Academy Archives.
With a real bona fide episode.
Yeah, this is our first episode that we're formally recording in our normal schedule for the rest of eternity.
Yeah, this is coming out in February of 2024. The last time we recorded an episode was in September of 2023.
And the last Archives episode we recorded was in July, so...
It's been a long time.
Yes, but we're so glad to be back and very excited to bring you some fun stuff today.
Mm-hmm. So first, of course, as in every Archives episodes, we have a Bosley review.
Yes. So for those of you who are new to the pod, Bosley is our beloved pup named for one of our favorite film critics,
Bosley Crowther.
And every week during our Archives episodes, he gives a review. But this Bosley review is always about a very lovely dog performer, since he himself is a dog.
Well, any kind of animal.
Animal performers.
Mostly dogs, though.
Of the animal kind. It is a dog review today. So today, Bosley wanted to mention, highlight a wonderful performance that doesn't get highlighted that often because we're not totally sure about the dog actor who played this dog, but about the film Hachiko. This is the Japanese film about the dog. It follows the story of Hachiko Monogatari, who is the dog that is the Akita that followed the professor to the train station. Do you know the story I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. The movie's called Hachi, A Dog's Tale or something.
There's multiple.
Oh.
Bosley's referring specifically to the 1987 Japanese film.
Oh, wow.
This is the original. So many of you may know there was a 2009 Richard Gere film.
Yeah.
A Dog's Tale. Yes, that's the one.
The fans have watched it many times.
Well, and that one is set in like Virginia or something. It's very Americanized. But the original story takes place in the 30s in Japan. And so in 1987, there was a Japanese film. And Bosley was looking into this time. And during the 80s, there were several rounds of like dog-led films, kind of like this one. You may know, of course, the film Milo and Otis, things like that were very, very popular in the culture at the time.
The return of the Benji films.
Exactly, exactly. So Bosley, of course, looked into this movie and wanted to just give a great praise to the Akitas that played Hachi in this film. It's so adorable, so adorable. Unfortunately, in doing some research, he was not able to identify the dogs or the handlers did this incredible performance. A lot of the animal actors in Japanese culture have been lost to time. Like they were not recorded as well.
Sure.
At least as far as his research could take him. But he wanted to highlight what a wonderful performance is because it follows a dog that is both a puppy all the way to adulthood. So there's lots of very cute little moments, lots of rough and tumble playing, and lots of just very emotional performance because it is kind of a sad story because it's about a dog who waits at the train station every day, even after his unofficial master has passed, and it's about a dog's loyalty and all that good stuff. So Bosley just wanted to shout out this wonderful performance since we are in the 80s and talking about these movies.
And what rating does Bosley give this film and the performances?
He gives it 15 long years at the train station of wonderfulness.
Oh my, wow. Bosley.
That's how long he would wait to watch it again.
Wow.
He said it is very sad, so beware.
That's true. All right, well, shall we get to the episode?
Let's get into it. So, Zachary, what are you talking about today?
So, of course, in these archive episodes, I always like to highlight another movie that came out during the year that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And this ceremony that we just talked about, not too recently, but the last episode that we did, was the 56th Academy Awards, in which Terms of Endearment won. And just looking through the other movies that came out that year, I wasn't really sure what to highlight, but I decided to highlight some music from this year, particularly because music in the 80s is very integral with movies.
Sure, yeah.
We just have a lot of huge popular hits that are like written for the films, but they transcend the films that they're a part of.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this a lot during Chariots of Fire, of course.
Yeah.
Even as we talked about Ordinary People and Pachelbel's Canon and Dee, and how that kind of made a resurgence in pop culture from that movie.
Yeah. So two of the films that came out that were nominated for a bunch of things and that won a few awards in this year of 1983 are Tender Mercies and Flashdance. Two extremely different films, but both have a lot to do with music, and their music was very important to the films and the success of the films. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about that. So first I'll talk about Flashdance. It's a really, really amazing movie. It is kind of in the vein of like a Footloose type movie musical where there's music happening, there's lots of dancing, it's like in the 80s and it's fun and everybody is like dressed in extremely 80s clothing and it's very of the era. It follows a young girl who is a steel worker and a ballerina.
Living her double life.
Yeah, it is based on a true story in a way. And the woman who the story is about, I won't go into too many details, but she was paid money for her story. And then when the film like made $200 million, she tried to sue the film because she was only paid $2,500. But when she made this deal, her lawyer was present and everything was like normal. She wasn't getting like suckered. They didn't know how the film was going to do. And so they ended up ruling in favor of the film. She didn't get any more money. But later then, when Jennifer Lopez did the famous dance from the film, she claimed that she invented that dance and the film used hers. So she ended up getting money from Jennifer Lopez, actually.
Oh, poor Jennifer Lopez. Didn't see it coming.
anyways, a weird thing about this film. But I want to talk about the music of the film. The film ended up having a budget of only $7 million, but it grossed, like I said, over $200 million. It was number three at the box office in 1983, behind Return of the Jedi and Terms of Endearment. And I specifically want to highlight Irene Cara, who is the first Black woman to win a non-acting Oscar.
Yeah, we mentioned this during our ceremony episode, but didn't get to spend a ton of time, so I'm glad you're focusing on this.
Yes. So she grew up in the Bronx. She was born to Puerto Rican and Cuban parents. Her dad was actually a steelworker, which is pretty interesting.
Meant to be. It was written in the stars.
She started performing at a very young age, and by the time she was 12, she was a regular on PBS's The Electric Company and had already appeared on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Nice.
So she was a famous dancer, singer, performer, entertainer in her young age. In 1985, she told Cosmopolitan, quote, "I don't mean to sound immodest, but I'd never had any doubt that I'd be successful, nor any fear of success. I was raised as a little goddess who was told she would be a star."
All right, go girl.
She appeared in a few productions on and off Broadway, and then in more TV shows until getting cast in the 1980 film Fame. After her initial audition was a bit of a letdown, she was cast as a dancer in the film. But during rehearsals, she was heard singing and was pulled aside to be told that the lead role of Coco Hernandez was going to be rewritten for her to play instead.
Wow, isn't that the actor's dream? It's like you wander off into the stairwell singing to yourself and some big producer walks by and says, "Where is that beautiful voice coming from?"
Well, apparently when she sang in her audition, it didn't go very well. Like she just had an off day.
Yeah.
And so she just got cast as a dancer because she was a really good dancer.
Sometimes I wonder how many people we miss out on because of that, who have a bad audition and could have been the lead of the movie. And that one day.
She ended up skyrocketing to fame from the part, especially due to two of the breakout songs from the film, Fame and Out Here on My Own. Both of those songs were nominated for Best Original Song at the Academy Awards, and it became the first time that two songs from the same film, sung by the same performer, were nominated.
Oh, nice.
This allowed her to be one of only a few performers to perform two different songs during an Oscar ceremony as well. Fame ended up winning the Oscar as well as the score of the film for Best Original Score. She also garnered two Grammy nominations for Best New Artist and Best Female Pop Vocal Performance, a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress in a Musical, and Billboard named her Top New Single Artist.
Wow.
And it's interesting because all of that came from this film.
Fame?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which like, normally you wouldn't get nominated for a Grammy for Best New Artist because you sang a song in a film.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right.
Whereas
yeah.
the song transcended the film so much that this all of this came from this film.
Wow.
So that's why I'm highlighting that. Okay. Like, the music and the film, especially in the 80s, go hand in hand so much.
Yeah, wow.
She then played Dorothy on the national tour of The Wiz.
Cool.
And then she shot a sitcom pilot for her own show titled Irene. And when it wasn't picked up, she decided to turn more to her music and recording career. She reached her peak within a couple years when she wrote what would be the title song for the hit film Flashdance, which was the song Flashdance, What a Feeling. She co-wrote the song with Giorgio Moroder, who was known as the father of disco, and Keith Forsey. She was a little nervous to work with Moroder. He had helped break Donna Summer onto the disco scene, and she really didn't want to be compared to Donna Summer.
Yeah, that's tricky when it's the same genre and similar types and all that.
But their collaboration went very well. Moroder composed the song, and Kara and Forsey wrote the lyrics in the car on the way to record the song. she then performed the song as well, though she was not in the movie. The song was an instant hit as well as the film, and along with another original song from the movie Maniac, it was nominated for Best Original Song, which it then won, making Irene Cara the first Black woman to win an Oscar outside of an acting category. And she became the youngest person at the time to win an Oscar for songwriting.
Nice.
Billie Eilish, of course, now holds that record.
Mm-hmm.
The song also won her the Grammy for Best Female Vocal Pop Performance and the Golden Globe for Best Original Song and two American Music Awards for Best R&B Female Artist and Best Pop Single of the Year.
Wow.
So all of that came from the song from the movie.
Cool.
Flashdance was also nominated for Best Cinematography, Best Film Editing, two for Best Original Song, which it won Best Original Song, for Flashdance, What a Feeling. I was really surprised that it was not nominated for Best Picture when I watched it, because other films similar to it are nominated for Best Picture at this time.
Hmm.
I think it's a case of one of those films in this era as we're like coming out of the era of blockbusters being nominated for Best Picture.
Sure.
I think it suffered from that.
Yeah.
It's also very woman-centric film, which are starting
Sick
to be not nominated for Best Picture anymore. So there's that. The other film that I wanted to mention is Tender Mercies. This is a very, very different film. It's kind of a more low-budget film starring Robert Duvall about a sort of failing, washed-up country singer in the middle of Nowheresville, Texas. It had a budget of $4.5 million, and it only grossed $8.5 million.
Mm.
It ended up being a really big film for Robert Duvall and Horton Foote.
Mm.
It was considered Foote's comeback to film because he had been really let down by a few of his adaptations that had made it to film. One of his screenplays that he wrote like was made very poorly, and he wasn't happy about that.
Tragic. That's a terrible feeling.
But he ended up coming back and writing this film. He really wanted to write it. He said later he didn't write it for Robert Duvall, but that while he was writing it, he wanted him to star in it.
That's writing it for Robert Duvall.
So I don't know.
I'm just thinking of this person all the time as I write this, but it's not for him.
Yeah. Once Duvall signed on, he spent a month driving around Texas, getting to know the people and recording their accents.
Oh.
He also spent time performing with small country bands on the weekends around Texas, even throughout filming. He made performing and singing the songs a part of his stipulation for being in the film.
Okay.
And he ended up writing original songs while he was doing it, and two of them made it into the film.
Hmm.
Fool's Waltz and I've Decided to Leave Here Forever.
Hmm.
He commented on this saying, quote, "What's the point if you're not going to do your own singing? They're just going to dub somebody else? I mean, there's no point to that."
What a great perspective to have in this age of current biopics of these huge music artists that we're just seeing all the time. Like, we're going to give Oscars to these people playing the greatest singers of all time.
And
they
aren't
even
singing
it. Yeah. I'm not referencing anything in particular, or am I?
Hmm. But of course he's from this era where like, I mean, he's from the Actors Studio.
Yes. He's the old guard of this. Yeah.
He ended up getting really praised for the singing.
Good.
By a lot of like country stars of the time, including Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. They both came out to say like, they were really impressed with him. The movie ended up having no original score at all, and the only music that is heard in the film is sung or played on screen by the characters.
Oh, that's cool.
Tender Mercies ended up being nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Robert Duvall, which he won.
Yeah.
And Best Original Screenplay for Horton Foote, which he won.
His comeback.
Yeah. And Best Original Song for Over You by Austin Roberts and Bobby Hart. And then I just want to highlight a few of the songs that got nominated or won Oscars in the 80s for Best Original Song.
The whole decade of the 80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just to show like how these songs have like really transcended the movies that they were in. So we have 9 to 5.
Working 9 to 5.
From Dolly Parton. On the Road Again by Willie Nelson.
Oh, great.
Endless Love by Lionel Richie. Up Where We Belong, which won. Eye of the Tiger, which did not win an Oscar.
I know. It's crazy.
I Just Called to Say I Love You by Stevie Wonder, which won. Footloose, Let's Hear It for the Boy. Say You, Say Me by Lionel Richie, which won. The Power of Love, Take My Breath Away, which won. The Time of My Life, which won. And Let the River Run by Carly Simon, which also won.
I love Carly Simon.
So all of those songs, I mean, they're like some of the most iconic songs of the 80s.
Yeah, and what's funny is a lot of those songs I don't attach to movies.
Right.
Just they just feel like 80s pop culture to me.
Yeah.
As a person who's removed from that.
Yeah. So, yeah, just wanted to highlight that as a big thing of the 80s as we're going through it.
Nice.
So why don't we switch gears a little bit and hear what you have to tell us about Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah. So today, I love to talk about a lot of the great stars of Hollywood. And
the great
I always
ladies.
Talk about the ladies because I love the ladies. And today I want to talk about another stronghold of the film industry, Shirley MacLaine. I will be honest, I really didn't know anything about her prior to this. And I love The Apartment. We've talked about this many times. I just love that movie. I love her performance in it. But other than that, Terms of Endearment was like the first time I'd seen her in something other than Steel Magnolias. So I just didn't know much about her as a performer or a person. So anyways, I just wanted to talk about her and her career since she does win the Academy Award for Best Actress at this 56th Academy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little overview. She, of course, is a multi-award winner. She has an Academy Award, an Emmy Award, 2 BAFTAs, 6 Golden Globes, 2 Volpe Cups, and 2 Silver Bears. She's also been honored with the Film Society of Lincoln Center Tribute, the Cecil B. DeMille Award in 1998, and an AFI Life Achievement Award as well.
Hmm.
Of course, she's been in the business forever, mm-hmm. and she also comes from a pretty big family that is... Whatever. I'll get into it.
Yeah, we've talked about her brother a few times.
Okay, great. So she was born April 24th, 1934. She and her brother share the same name, MacLaine Beatty, but he took Beatty and she took MacLaine, and they kind of went their separate ways and mm-hmm. tried to do their own thing in their career. She's actually named after Shirley Temple, who was 6 when she was born.
Mm.
Her parents named her after her. Her mother was a drama teacher and an artist and a performer and all that stuff. Her father had a very artistic leaning as well. And so they kind of just pushed both of their children into the arts from a very early age. She started ballet at 3 and performed all throughout school. She did, theater classes. She did summer camps, all that kind of stuff. And then the summer before her senior year of high school, she went to New York City to try out Broadway and was cast in an ensemble role in the new musical Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of her first like little taste. She did end up going back to high school and finished her senior year. She graduated and then returned straight to New York right afterwards. She was in the dancing ensemble for the Broadway production of Mean Juliet from 1953 to 54. And then she kind of had her big break very shortly after this in 54. She became the understudy for actress Carol Hanney in The Pajama Game in 1954, of course. And luckily for her, she ended up replacing her during a matinee when Hanney broke her ankle.
Mm.
And it was bad enough that she ended up replacing her for the remainder of the show. And a few months later, she was still injured, so she was still doing this role, when film producer Halbie Wallace came by.
Uh-huh.
He saw her performance and immediately signed her to work for Paramount Pictures. She had her film debut just a year later with the film Trouble with Harry from Alfred Hitchcock. And for this film, she won a Golden Globe for New Star of the Year.
Uh-huh.
And she was only 18.
Wow, good for her.
So all of this happens like from like 16 to 18.
Mm-hmm.
That's just insane. And her career took off very, very quickly. The next thing she did was Artists and Models with Dean Martin in 1955. Then she followed this up with a bunch more films that were just very popular. She immediately did Around the World in 80 Days in 1956. She did four films in 1958, Hot Spell, The Sheepman, The Matchmaker, which culminated in her first Best Actress Academy Award nomination for the film Some Came Running, which also had Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra in it.
Hmm.
And this starts her on this path of like kind of her place in the Hollywood culture. So yeah. She starts running with Dean Martin, with Frank Sinatra, with the boys, as you may consider, the Rat Pack, all those people.
Mm-hmm.
She starts to like fit in with the boys club. Shortly after this, she starred in Can-Can with them again. And then she was in Ocean's 11 as uh-huh. the one woman character among the 11 suave men.
Great.
And of course, she really loved hanging out with these guys. About this, she said, quote, "I was comfortable and friendly being around the guys in the group because I was perceived by most of them as a mascot. There had been a kind of communal decision made that I wasn't really a girl. I was a pal. It would come as a shock to me later when gently and separately, both Dean and Frank visited my hotel room when no one else was looking." So, you know, she was kind of like a guy's guy during this time. That was kind of the culture that she hung out with. And, you know, she did have some trouble because we haven't talked about the Rat Pack at all. Like, mm-hmm. that's not really the line of stuff we've gone down with this podcast. But they were known as kind of rough and tumble.
Mm-hmm.
She said about them, quote, "They moved with self-assured pride, tossing away jokes and $100 bills to bellboys. They were primitive children and their reactions were adolescent. They put crackers in each other's bed and dumped spaghetti on new tuxedos." And she both loved and hated this. She loved the thrill of it, but also because she was a woman, she was allowed to sort of be on the outside of it. But she was the only woman allowed to be this way, which mm-hmm. is a very unique position to be in. During this time also, in 1954, she married businessman Steve Parker. They stayed married. They stayed married, technically, until 1982 when they divorced. And they have one daughter together, Sachi. But in 2011, she did an interview with Oprah Winfrey where she talked about how they had an open marriage the whole time.
Hmm.
This has been speculated about by her daughter. You know, lots of people say lots of things. It was widely known that she had tons of affairs. And the question is more of like the vernacular around it. Were they affairs? Were they flings? Was it an open marriage and everything was fine? Like, I don't know. Does it matter? I don't know.
It's always a little strange when those people who, like people like her, marry people who are outside of the industry.
Yeah.
And they're like big, rich people, mm-hmm. either a rich man or woman
mm-hmm.
outside the industry. And I don't know. It feels weird because this happens a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And I feel like also it often corresponds with romances with the people you're working with as well.
Right.
And that's what she said. All of her flings, she like could not help herself from falling for whoever she was working with. She said the only people she did not fall for were Jack Lemmon and Jack Nicholson.
Well, and it's funny because those people almost marry the stars because, I don't know, of like the status.
Right.
And mm-hmm. not because they love them or want to be with them.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. So yeah. Weird and interesting.
Yeah. She also had a very tricky relationship with her daughter. The reality is that Shirley MacLaine's personality, I mean, you can see it in her movies.
Yeah.
She is who she is and she's going to do what she wants to do. So there was a lot of talk that she may not have been the best mother. Her husband, Steve Parker, ended up moving to Japan and she sent Sachi to live with him there while she continued to do her thing. Also, I'll get into this in a little bit, but she was very, very into New Age stuff, transcendentalism,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of that stuff. That's like one of her defining character traits, mm-hmm. like especially as we get into the like 60s and 70s. And so there was a lot of weird stuff that happened where she believed like in reincarnation and stuff. And Sachi, their daughter, claims that her father convinced Shirley MacLaine that he was a clone of an extraterrestrial named Paul.
Oh,
who was Sachi's true father, who did important work for the U.S. government in space. So then Shirley MacLaine was paying him a stipend and doing all this. There was like a bunch of like weird manipulation of her religious beliefs or personal beliefs and money going to different places. And then the money, of course, is like he's squandering it and getting more from her and all this kind of stuff. Lots of weird stuff. Shirley MacLaine says this is not true, that she knew that he was lying because she did a channeling session and knew that the whole extraterrestrial thing with him wasn't real, whatever.
She had found the real Paul.
She found the real Paul in space. Whatever the truth was, he ended up bankrupting her, which is why they divorced in 1982. Mm. But what's crazy, the last thing I'll say about him, is that technically he died in 2001, but they weren't really sure because one day Shirley MacLaine called up her daughter and was like, guess who I saw today? Steve the clone. He was in the valley buying coffee. And she thought she had seen him around. So he was a little bit of a con man. It's hard to know. Their relationship was very weird. And I don't know. She has some strange, strange beliefs. Well, I say strange because I don't believe them. But like, and so I think that there was a lot wrapped up in the way she perceived the world.
Your husband is a clone from space is a little bit strange.
Yeah, well, and like, I mean, she has even said things like she said that in her previous life she lived in Atlantis, that she was the brother of a 35,000 year old spirit named Ramtha. She she's written multiple books on this. Like, they're her most popular thing. She's written books like Saging While Aging about her alien encounters that she had in the desert. And yes. When she attended the Oscars in 2017, everyone like jumped to their feet and applauded her. And she said, quote, that's the nicest reception I've had in 250,000 years.
Oh, wow. Good for her.
So, you know, a little kooky. And here's what I'll say about it. I think it's a little kooky. And she's known for being that way.
Yeah.
But she believes what she believes and she just does her thing.
Yeah.
And I can't fault her for that. So around this time in 1959, going back to where I was, Shirley MacLaine sued Hal Wallace, who had originally discovered her as part of Paramount Pictures, over a contractual dispute. And this lawsuit, we actually talked about it back when. And so I'm not going to go into now, but this lawsuit is a really big part of what ended up breaking down officially the old style studio star system and actor management. We talked about both Bette Davis and Olivia de Havilland, how they both sued. They were like the first two steps. Of course, Bette Davis lost her lawsuit. Olivia de Havilland won. And Shirley MacLaine is credited with formally breaking the system.
Well, and part of it, too, is because Paramount is also like under investigation during this time, and all the antitrust stuff.
Yes. Yes.
And they're the first studio that gets told that they're not allowed to own distribution like theaters anymore.
Yeah. The monopolies got busted big time.
And funny enough, we're back in a place where studios make their own movies and distribute them online. Yeah. And I don't know. It's a monopoly, too. Who knows?
It goes around and it comes around and it goes around and comes around. But kudos to her. Of course, she's such a ballsy person and she went for it. And, you know,
yeah,
this is a huge part of her legacy. So in 1960, she finally formally cements herself as one of the greats with Billy Wilder's The Apartment.
Mm-hmm.
This gets her her second Oscar nomination, which everyone agrees she should have won. Mm. I think she should have won. And of course, sadly, she lost to Elizabeth Taylor. Crickets. But this film and this role, we talked about it extensively in that episode, it really became her signature. It defined what a woman could be in a rom-com in a new way. She encapsulates this modern woman. She shows who she is very, very clearly and has depth and nuance and all that beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily for her, her career didn't tank right afterwards either.
Yeah.
We talk about this all the time, how people
win.
Well,
she didn't win, so.
I know. Oh, yeah. I guess that's true. See, here's the thing. In my mind, she won.
Yeah, you think she wins.
It's a career high for her. And so this kind of launches her into like the world of the other people who are doing the stuff she wants to do. So the next film she does is The Children's Hour with Audrey Hepburn, which is based on the Lillian Hellman play directed by William Wyler. Then she follows it up with Irma La Duce with William Wyler again and Jack Lemmon. This leads to her third Best Actress nomination. And also just a little like caveat here is that during this time, she just really enjoyed what she was doing. She writes in her memoirs, thinking very positively and refreshingly on this time with her female co-stars, that she really enjoyed working with people like Audrey Hepburn and just like had such a wonderful time. There was so much camaraderie. She also like talks about some of the women she works with later, Dolly Parton and Sally Field and Julia Roberts and all that. I say this because there comes a point in her career where she becomes notorious, specifically in the like 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. of being a very, very difficult actress to work with. But during the 60s, she seems to generally get along with the people she's working with. And this is a great time for her career, sadly, but also to her benefit, I guess. She replaces Marilyn Monroe in two films that she had planned to be in before she passed.
Yeah.
And this era of like the blockbuster movie musical and stuff helps Shirley MacLaine really catapult her career further because she is a singer and a dancer and has done Broadway and all that good stuff. So moving right along during this time to 1969, she's cast in the lead of Sweet Charity, directed by Bob Fosse, with Gwen Verdon assisting. She was originally going to play the lead role, but they wanted a name, so they put Shirley MacLaine in it instead. She just loved this film, but sadly, it just didn't do very well. It was not a financial success.
And I mean, none of Bob Fosse's films were, unfortunately.
No, sadly. I mean, at least I think fondly on them, but they just were not.
Yeah.
They didn't hit it out of the park. I also want to interject here that, like, she starts becoming a Spitfire very publicly during this time. One of the like big incidents that happened was she marched into the office of the Hollywood Reporter and punched columnist Mike Connolly in the mouth. She like starts doing stuff that just gets more and more public about like her temper and her anger. And I think it's a really interesting thing to look back on in history because she's portrayed as this very angry woman. And yes, she is. But how many men were given freedom to do this kind of stuff? And it's laughed off as like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've told so many stories about men walking into people's offices and punching them or like destroying something of theirs. Or, and like, it's seen as really funny.
Yeah. Or like, pranking each other in ways that are completely inappropriate. Or even on set, you know, punching walls, breaking glasses, doing things that are very publicly dangerous. And it's part of the process or the method. But, you know, Shirley MacLaine gets punished or scolded or she's not being demure or being ladylike or whatever. And like, don't get me wrong. She has a rough personality, but so many other men do, too. And so it's hard to like.
Yeah.
Yeah. The 70s were a rough time for her. her career had a big downturn. She was in the Western Two Mules for Sister Sarah with Clint Eastwood that was successful. Unfortunately, it was not because of her and it didn't help her. The film's director, Don Siegel, said, quote, "It's hard to feel any great warmth to her. She's too unfeminine and she has too much balls. She's very, very hard." So she kind of started to hit this wall in Hollywood. So she decided to pivot to TV. She tried to do a sitcom called Shirley's World. Didn't really work out. So she just decides to take a little career break. She campaigns for the election in 1972. She gets super, super into transcendentalism, her spiritual practices. She gets really politically involved. She's a big activist during this time as well. She gets into supernatural films. She's really interested in that. During the 70s, she was very, very seriously considered for The Exorcist because she was very close friends with William Friedkin. And it's very clearly known that the character of Chris McNeil, the main character in it, is based on her because William Friedkin had actually spent the weekend with her and her daughter previous to writing this. And there are so many characteristics that match both her and her daughter. They ended up using photos of her daughter in the film.
Oh, my.
She thought that she was going to be in the film, but unfortunately, they did not want to work with her because she had just done a very similar film called The Possession of Joel Delaney in 1972 that didn't do very well.
Oh.
And so they didn't want to put her face on this as well.
Hmm.
He had used personal details from her life. Like, there's some funny interviews where she's very sour about this, like reflecting on this, that like she was not involved in this film. I think it might have changed her career if she was. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
But it didn't work out. She tried a new thing. She co-directed a documentary called The Other Half of the Sky, a China memoir about Chinese women's experiences. And it was nominated for Best Documentary in 1975. And then finally had kind of a comeback in 1977 when she starred in The Turning Point with Anne Bancroft, which is about a retired ballerina. And she was nominated for Best Actress for the fourth time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things stay slow for the next couple of years, but in 1983, she turns the tide finally.
Huzzah!
She does The Terms of Endearment, and she wins Best Actress, and it is both a commercial and critical success, and people start to, like, change their tune about her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of, like, brassy, rough woman is, like, very desirable again. Her mm-hmm. performance is great. People are interested in her again, and she's kind of able to, like, capitalize on being herself in films for the rest of this decade.
Mm-hmm.
Right after this, she does a couple other films. Of course, she does Steel Magnolias soon afterwards, which is great. She's the perfect Weezer in this film.
Yeah.
Like, it's a great role for her. Of course, it's a great movie and great ensemble work and all that stuff. But it was, like, a very smart move to, like, continue to find these roles that are very specifically these, like, ornery, sort of brassy older women who have a lot of heart, mm-hmm. who have a soft center, even though they're so hard on the outside.
Yeah.
Shortly after this, she also does Postcards from the Edge, which I had not heard of before this, but I want to watch it now because she plays Debbie Reynolds alongside Meryl Streep.
Oh.
It's directed by Mike Nichols and written by Carrie Fisher.
Oh, interesting.
I had never heard of this movie before.
I feel like I've heard of it just because of knowing some of the things that Carrie Fisher did.
Okay.
Like that she wrote something like that.
Well, and she and Carrie Fisher ended up having a working relationship. She also does her television series, These Old Broads, which Carrie Fisher wrote.
Mm-hmm.
That series co-starred Elizabeth Taylor, Debbie Reynolds, Joan Collins, and her.
Oh, my.
Just so crazy. She found during this time also, as like her later career went on, that television was a great avenue for her. She did that. She also did the series Coco Before Chanel, where she played Coco Chanel. And then, of course, she does Downton Abbey.
Uh-huh.
Which...
The American grandmother.
She's the American grandmother. And I remember when we watched Downton Abbey and she came on, I was like, ah, she looks like my grandma. She like looks and acts just like her. And I just was like, oh, yep. She's the American grandma through and through.
So funny.
And then, of course, she's also in Only Murders in the Building.
Oh.
And that's kind of like her career. She's still alive. She's out here doing her thing. But I just thought it was a really fun time to talk about her because she's another one of those women who kind of found herself later in life.
Mm.
She had been in the industry for so long. She had major success in the 60s. We all know her and love her from The Apartment, but had ebbs and flows and found a way to like really come back around and really bring it back around. And she has found such a very specific niche in the industry. She's doing something that I think a lot of women don't want to do.
Mm.
A lot of women don't want to be perceived or portrayed the way that she allows herself to be. And I think she's a very honest person to a fault sometimes, most of the time. But she's very true to who she is and plays roles that are close to who she is. And I think that that is very recognizable as an audience member.
Mm-hmm.
You see those people and you're like, oh yeah, I know those women. I know who that is. And like, while I don't love her personality, I'm not going to lie. Like it's, I don't really enjoy a lot of the interviews I watched. Like, I don't know that I would ever like admire her as like a person or a friend. I still really respect so much people who are who they are and find a way to showcase that and bring beauty to that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that I love my brassy ladies
of
Hollywood. I would probably feel similarly to Betty Davis if I got to see all of her many interviews complaining about everyone. But yeah, that's what I have to share today about Shirley MacLaine and her contributions to Hollywood history and the Academy Awards.
Congrats to her.
Yeah, congrats to her. I'm glad she won her Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
Much deserve it after a long, lengthy career.
Yes, for sure. Well, and with that, we come to our final segment of the show where we thank the Academy for things relating to the films or the people that we discuss in these episodes. What would you like to thank the Academy for today, Kristen?
I would like to thank the Academy for parents that treat you like a goddess and tell you you can do anything.
Oh, wow.
That stood out to me when you said that. When Irene Cara just knew who she was, she had this self-confidence. And, you know, her parents instilled that in her. She believed that about herself. And she went out and she just did it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? There's too many people out here who belittle themselves, who get caught up in their heads and throw it away. You can do anything. That's what I learned today.
I would like to thank the Academy for the sexy musical films of the 80s. I mean, there's so many of them. And whether or not the music is like it's a musical or it's just filled with music and dancing and like fun times.
Yeah. It's so funny. A lot of those movies you mentioned, I feel like they're so bad and I'm not allowed to watch them. Like Flashdance or Dirty Dancing or Footloose. Like they, in my mind, they're so bad. But like I watched Footloose for the first time a couple years ago and I was like, this is so innocent. Like,
well, and I remember some friends of ours who were from California. They moved to the East Coast and they had grown up watching these movies. And so she called my mom to be like, hey, can we watch Dirty Dancing like with everybody?
And your mom is like, what?
Well, and my mom was kind of like, yeah, go ahead. Like, because she's into musicals also.
Oh, yeah.
And like
your mom is,
that
era.
And it was funny because they were a family of mostly boys, but we all watched it. And I mean, they were the family that I watched Les Mis with and listened to with and like all of that kind of stuff. But I just remember watching that movie, too, as like a young, I don't know, like 10 years old, just thinking like, wow, this is so crazy.
Wow, that's funny. Because I had the opposite experience where my mom was like, Dirty Dancing? Dirty and dancing? No way.
Well, and there's literally no dirty dancing in Dirty Dancing.
Or same thing like, with like Footloose. It's like, you're going to dance in a bad way? No siree. Of course, like not having seen the movies, no, we didn't know. My family didn't know. That these are just dance and movie musicals.
But yeah, they're fun. So thanks to the Academy for that.
I would like to thank the Academy for equal rights for women punching reporters.
Oh, wow.
Is it right? No, certainly not. But I support women's wrongs as much as I support women's rights.
I would like to thank the Academy for Robert Duvall. This is his one and only win.
Oh,
we got to mention it here.
Yeah,
but he's in like so many movies. We'll talk about him again throughout this podcast. But this is really his main era, the 70s and mid 80s.
Sure.
Because, of course, he did The Godfather, which he got nominated for. Apocalypse Now, he was nominated for that. The Great Santini, which he was also nominated for. Finally, he wins for Tender Mercies. But he ended up being nominated three more times after this in his career. For The Apostle, for Civil Action all the way in 99, and then for The Judge in 2015.
Oh, my.
But he has no other Academy wins other than this. And maybe he'll be in something again and get another nomination. You never know, people in their old age. But
what the lesson is, pare it down. You don't need to do The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. You could just do a small country film.
Yeah.
And that's how you show your real stuff.
Yep. So congrats to him on that win. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
We're finally back at it.
Yeah, we'll be back next week and our schedule should be normal going forward. And as always, I mean, it's been a while, but if you can, please follow us on social media.
Yeah.
We're on all the things. We have our Instagram and our Twitter and all that stuff. We are also on Letterboxd, so feel free to follow us there. You can see all the lists and movies and things we're watching and whatnot. That's always fun. And also, if you have not, please rate us on all platforms and give us a nice review. That just really helps people to know what they're getting into and to trust us.
Well, and whenever a review is written, it boosts listening. Like,
yes,
it really sends the podcast out to other people, you know, suggests it
to
them.
Helps people find it that may not know what it is, all that good stuff.
Yeah. Well, so thanks for listening. And then join us next week when we discuss the 57th Academy Awards and the Best Picture winner, Amadeus.
Thank you for tuning in to Thank the Academy. You can follow us on social media at Thank the Academy Podcast on Instagram and Thank Academy Pod on X. If you enjoy listening to the show, make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify podcasts and subscribe on your favorite streaming platforms. The theme song was created by the one and only Noah Heisinger. Join us next week on Thank the Academy.